with Aaron, Polly, and Wayne. I'm Aaron.
This is Paul.
And this is Wayne.
Guys, I'm deep into the unpacking of my office, you know, after the big move. And I find that I'm getting sidetracked by things that I'm unpacking, you know, and it's not one of those things that drives me crazy where you unpack the dish and go, oh, you know, my Aunt Martha gave me this dish and I really am, you know, fond of that.
Why did you say that name?
Aunt Martha?
Martha. Why'd you say that name? Sorry, continue.
You're killing Martha. Anyway, so I unpacked my Deadpool head and have moved it to a place of honor on my desk. And so I have been, you know, I work from home most of the time, and I have to tell you, it's on during a lot of meetings. I'm just saying. So
just looking at you like, huh?
Yeah, and I love the cocked eye that it throws at you. I'm a big fan of it. So, but yeah, I've been unpacking things. I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot I had this. You know,
the Deadpool head in our house is on the bookshelf overlooking the bedroom.
Nice. So he's watching you.
Always watching. Uh-huh. Always.
Well, Deadpool likes to watch.
He does. Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of Deadpool, so. You know, physical media is dying, right? Even in the movie space, like Best Buy no longer sells Blu-rays or and things like that. But there are certain movies I still just want. Like I want the physical copy of them, and usually it's MCU or, you know, a Star Wars movie or something like that. Not that there's been one in a while, but yeah, there are movies I want physically, not just digitally. Well, Deadpool and Wolverine was one of them. Just because I want it available when I want it available. And it came with a digital code. So that's like a, you know, like when I used to, during the days of me stopping buying physical copies of comics, the ones I tended to buy physically were the ones that had the digital code. But Deadpool and Wolverine is now out on Blu-ray and 4K and all that crap, right? So I pre-ordered the Steelbook edition from Amazon.com. And the cost of it was $65.99. And I'm like, that can't be right. And they're like, don't. And you know, I looked it up and they're like, don't worry. That's just the initial price. But when it actually releases, Amazon will only charge you the final cost. It'll probably be closer to the normal price of these types of things, like $30. I'm like, all right, that's fine. Son of a bitch. It was $65.99. when it actually released. And it really stung me in the way of, you know, I worked at a video store when I was a very young kid. My dad owned a video store. Yep. And back in those days, VHS tapes were like $99.99.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Until the days of like Dirty Dancing and the Tim Burton Batman.
Well, until Paramount started releasing those 1999 movies.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then they would have the price for home. So like a movie would come out in, the video stores first, and it would be another, say, 6 months or so before you could buy them at home.
Right. Yeah.
I remember wanting to buy Spawn, and we actually asked the
Spawn.
Yeah. I was young. I made stupid mistakes.
I get it. I probably owned it too.
But yeah, we wanted to buy it, and I asked the video store, and they're like, it'd be $120. We're like, what?
Yeah.
Crazy. But yeah, I was shocked. It was, you know, with tax, it was $70 for Deadpool and Wolverine on Blu-ray. And I'm like, son of a bitch.
That's insane.
That being said, you can buy the straight Blu-ray with the digital code for $25. It was the Steelbook edition that I wanted. That was stupid.
Yeah.
But you can actually get it cheaper. But I was rather frustrated that, like, because usually, you know, it used to be that Steelbook editions were just like store exclusives, right? Like it was the same cost, but you had to go to Best Buy to get it.
Right.
Well, now Best Buy doesn't have it, so now they just bilk you. But yes, you can buy it cheaper. You can buy it $25, $30, depending on, you know, the version you want.
Doesn't Deadpool and Wolverine start streaming on Disney Plus this week?
It does, but I wanted the physical edition for when it goes away, because it will go away, right?
Yeah.
At some point.
Well, and you say that physical media is going away, and while I will grant you that physical media is not nearly as popular as it used to be, I've seen a number of articles on how the numbers are improving.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, not like not there. It's never going to be what it was, but that they have certainly seen over the last 2 years, kind of a return to physical media.
I suspect that's because a lot of things got pulled, especially things that were made just for one streaming service, yep, and then suddenly are gone.
I think that's exactly it. And I think there are certain things that are just evergreen, that people know that they're going to watch and rewatch, that they want to have. And that's what I've limited myself to picking up. And, you know, I do exactly what Paul describes, where I try to match the physical media to a digital code. So I have it both ways. But, you know, I have lately bought a bunch of old stuff that I can't find streaming anywhere. You know, like some old, you know, John Wayne Westerns and whatnot that just, you know, you can't even buy it to stream as a digital rental. You know,
I do find that sucky sometimes, like when I really want to see something and it's not even available for purchase. And there are things like that. And there are especially old TV shows like that, mm-hmm, because of music rights. Right. There was some TV show that, oh, the werewolf TV, the, it was a TV show called Werewolf back in the 80s that, mm-hmm, I used to love as a kid. And I had intended on, it was going to be released, but music rights held it up. And I'm like, can't you just like insert new music at some point? But yeah, no, some of the stuff just literally.
Miami Vice had that problem released for such a
long time. Oh, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm,
yeah, classic versions of like thing for it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Friends, and I mean, there are TV shows like Friends and those types of things that, people don't realize because now they've been watching them for streaming for such a long time that they're used to them in the way that they are. But music has been replaced in a lot of those shows. Supernatural, yeah, is one of them. You know, you'd have to buy the original DVDs just to get the original music, but the streaming versions have different music, stuff like that. But it's just interesting because, yeah, I mean, I do think, you know, I am very much, and I think we've talked about this on the show before, like sometimes I'll own something on Blu-ray upstairs and I won't go up and get it.
Right. Yeah.
But I want it accessible if I need it. Right.
Yeah. So you hit on my issue, Paul. I don't buy physical media and I don't buy it because I won't use it. Even if it's something that I can't get streaming, I'll just watch something else because it just is too much hassle for me to put in physical media. I don't have so the only thing I have that plays physical media is my PlayStation, and I don't have any of my controllers charged or know where they're at right now.
I have a 4K Blu-ray player that I got for Christmas a few years back because I tend to buy, you know, I'm big in the horror movies and I know you guys aren't, but you know, there are companies that will take classic horror movies and things like that and re-release special editions, but the special editions don't include digital or don't include a digital code. So I don't know. Let's just say like The Thing, right? I'm sure I can buy that readily on any streaming service, yeah, but there'll be a special 4K edition of The Thing with a feature length documentary that's exclusive to this edition. And those are the types of things that I still buy physical media for. But
yeah, I mean, I am right there with you. I don't like I gotta get up and I gotta put the disc in. You know, I gotta find the disc. I gotta put the disc in and know where the
Blu-ray. Spoken like three middle-aged dudes.
Yeah. I totally get that. But, you know, if it's something I want to watch, I will do that. My big reason for liking the option to stream is that I watch a lot of things on the patio. You know, I watch a lot of things out in the backyard. And of course, I don't want to, you know, tote a Blu-ray out there. So, you know, streaming is great for that. I wish this is one of those things I just cannot believe that they haven't manufactured is a Blu-ray player that broadcasts streaming, you know, that you could stream to a device in another room or outside. Just like
with the Roku 4K Blu-ray player, you know.
Yeah.
Now, I will say the one thing that Roku has done, and I'm probably preaching to the choir, but Roku has released a sound bar. So it is a sound bar that has a built-in Roku to it. And so we purchased one of those, and I love it. I mean, don't get me wrong. The sound is not it's not the same as a Bose, right, sound bar, but it's, you know, but TVs nowadays are not built for quality sound. They want to encourage you to buy things like sound bars and,
right,
and you know, things like, yeah, that. So, but the Roku sound bar, it's just great because it's just one, you know, it's the Roku. Plug it into the TV, you have your sound and your Roku all through the same thing, and it works great. And so that's we use that in our kind of like our main TV.
Yeah.
I don't have any ear good enough to distinguish differences. So I'm fine with TV sound, always have been. In my case, I said, I know I won't put it in, even if it's something I really want to see. And there are things that I have that are not streaming, mostly stuff out of Japan. And I just haven't watched them in years because it's not going to happen.
No hentai for you, huh?
He gets all that streaming.
He gets all that online for free.
Yeah, now. No, right. Paul, hentai is streaming.
Oh, God. Well, you know, since we're talking about streaming media, we did not record last week. So we have not had a chance to touch base on the end of Agatha All Along. But Aaron, before we get into Agatha All Along, and just to bore Wayne for another minute and bury the lead, I watched Lioness.
The first season.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, our sister podcast, Jellystone, with Aaron and Polly.
Right.
Sure to be a major hit.
Our hit podcast, Jellystone.
Our soon-to-be hit podcast, Jellystone, with Aaron and Polly, which, hey, as of this recording, Yellowstone will be back on TV tomorrow night. Very exciting.
That is crazy. I mean, it's like Jesus coming back.
It is. It's been like 2-3 years. I mean, there are kids in that show who are like adults now.
That's
since,
right.
Since the last episode. Yeah. So they're going to have to do a time jump.
Yellowstone will return like a thief in the night. That's what I'm saying.
But the creator of that, Taylor Sheridan, also has a number of other TV shows he's created. We've talked about a number of them, like 1883, 1923, Tulsa King. He's got a new one coming out. Mayor of Kingstown. He's got one coming out called Landman, I think, with Billy Bob Thornton, which looks really good.
It does look good. It does look good.
But he has one out on Paramount Plus now called Lioness. Or the first season, I think, was called Special Ops Lioness, even though it doesn't actually say that on the title card in the show. Yeah. I think that was just kind of to sell it. And it stars Zoe Saldana, Morgan Freeman.
Was Morgan Freeman in the first season?
He was in like the last half.
Okay.
He was not at the beginning, and I was like, when does Morgan Freeman show up? But yeah, he comes in once they...
Nicole Kidman's in it.
Nicole Kidman's in it. Yeah. And, you know, I had heard it's a slow burn.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, okay, like, what isn't in Taylor Sheridan's world?
That's right.
I think the show is excellent.
Yeah, no, it's really good.
It's really good. Well acted. And if you're a fan, you know, how I got introduced to Taylor Sheridan was not via Sons of Anarchy. It was via Sicario.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much like Sicario meets Miami Vice.
I would agree.
You know, the women go undercover with like drug dealers. And except it's, you know, kind of enabled by the CIA. So you have that government connection. And I think it's just a really good show. And so I actually watched the first season. Second season's already like halfway through or something on Paramount Plus. I haven't started that.
But, it's got that guy in it from House of Cards.
I've never actually seen House of Cards.
Did you say the name?
It's not her husband. You're talking about the other guy.
Yeah. Who works for Nicole Kidman.
He's so good.
He is. And I mean, I cannot remember his name, but he played Mike in he was also in Jack Ryan. And
yes.
He played Mike in Jack Ryan. And I just love that guy. And he's in it. And
Kelly is his name.
Thank you, Michael Kelly. I knew his name was Mike. He's fantastic in it. I really enjoy him. You can have him on the screen for a minute and I'm happy. He's just – there's an energy about him that I really dig. He seems dangerous, you know.
Yeah. Apparently he's also in the Penguin TV show, which is coming up next. I'm going to watch that next because this is – the reason I started Lioness is I finished Agatha All Along.
Yep.
And I was like, okay, what's the next show I want to watch? And I was like, let me give this one a shot. You know, there's so much out there. But Taylor Sheridan, other than the fact that he just doesn't finish things
– yeah. On time or at all.
Or at all. Has rarely steered me wrong from a quality perspective. Now, I did not see that Bass Reeves show, but you said it.
And boy, you should not. It was awful. It was awful. As much as I love that story from history, was super interested in it. There was not enough there to keep me beyond three episodes. It was so, so very bad.
I don't think I've ever seen a Taylor Sheridan show.
You know,
it might not be your jam. Say that in a bad way, but it's just, you know, it's all very it's either Western or like government action, you know, like military action. It's one of it's like that's Taylor Sheridan stuff is all that. The one exception that you may actually enjoy is Tulsa King with Sylvester Stallone.
So good.
And it's just because it's almost like a dark comedy. There's so much humor to it. And that's more of a mobster type show.
It's and a fish out of water show, right? Because he's the New York mafia guy, old school mafia guy who gets exiled to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And so he's setting up his own business there in Tulsa. And there's a bit of hilarious to it and tragic. I mean, there's some tragic to it as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love almost all of their shows. I'm not a fan of Mayor of Kingstown, but I don't like prison dramas. So
I haven't seen the third season of Mayor of Kingstown, but the first two were fine. You know, I think that one falls into very much the way, David Boreanaz, SEAL Team,
fell into Boreanaz.
Is that it's a guy show. Uh-huh. That's a fine time waster, but it's not like
my problem with Mayor of Kingstown is that there's no joy in it. You know, it is just very grim all the way through. Whereas every other thing that Taylor Sheridan does, there's a lot of tragedy involved, but there's also joy. And there's just none in Mayor of Kingstown. And you wouldn't expect any in a prison drama. But God, I mean, I watch it and I'm like, I just can't. I want to open a vein, you know.
Yeah.
It's just people doing terrible things to each other, and it's hard to like anybody in that show, including Diane Wiest. I mean, it is hard to like anybody in that show.
There are definitely shows like that. That was how I felt, when I was watching Game of Thrones, I watched the first season, and after that, it's like, I am not in a place mentally where I can keep watching a show like this, where it is horrible people doing horrible things to each other and there is nobody to like. And if you do like them, they're going to die.
No, I get that. I mean, you know, there are things that you have to be mentally prepared for, emotionally prepared for, and other things. It's just like, I don't want to live here. You know, I don't want to invite this into my mind. And that's how I feel about Mayor of Kingstown. I think Jeremy Renner is a fine actor. I don't think he's got enough charisma to carry that show.
Agreed. He's just very dry. You know, I mean, I think of Jeremy Renner in real life, he seems relatively charismatic, but
he doesn't strike me as leading man.
No. And I think he's just trying to brood too hard. The entire time.
Agreed.
But Agatha All Along, they had a two-part season or series finale, I should probably say, because I don't believe there's any plans for a second season. It does end on a cliffhanger, but I doubt there would be an Agatha All Along season two to resolve it.
No, I think it's more likely to be a Wiccan spinoff, you know, or Young Avengers or something of that ilk. I don't think we're done with Agatha at the end of the series. I just think we're done with the Agatha series.
Yeah. So 9 episodes, you know, the last two episodes, basically the climax happens in the 8th episode and the 9th episode, but the 8th episode ends in a twist that basically the 9th episode's, you know, the denouement, ends up explaining kind of, you know, the twist that's revealed at the end of episode 8, which, you know, Wayne, I know, you know, you've already read spoilers, but if you choose to close your ears or whatever, that's fine. You know, which is that the whole Witch's Road stuff was really all fabricated by Billy. Billy has his mother's powers, right? And just like she fabricated the town of Westview, maybe.
Correct. Westview.
You know, Westview in the way she did it, he very much fabricated the entire journey of the Witch's Road, because that's what he had that's what he wanted. Now, the Witch's Road was a legend, but it's revealed in the 9th episode that the Witch's Road was just a legend created by Agatha
as a con.
As a con to lure witches to kill them and take their powers. But the legend grew to the point that Billy believed it real and made it real.
I enjoyed the series. I have a problem, and this is just me as comic nerd coming into the TV show and wrestling with the MCU interpretation of a character. I saw an interview with who's her face, Catherine whatever her name is from Agatha All Along.
Why am I not remembering her name?
What's it? Wait,
Han.
Thank you. Yeah. And she's like, oh, yeah, you know, no one's ever heard of Agatha Harkness. And I'm like, okay, well, I get that the world at large hasn't heard of Agatha Harkness, but if you are a comic book reader and a reader of the Fantastic Four, you know who Agatha Harkness is.
Yeah, Franklin's babysitter. And
that's right.
The tutor of anyone that does any sort of magic.
Yeah, and, you know, has this, you know, deeply embedded history with the Witches of Salem, the Secret Society of Salem and the Salem Seven and her son Nicholas Scratch and yada, 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 yada. There is a backstory to Agatha, and I guess what bugs me so much about this show, and don't get me wrong, I enjoyed the show, but they made her such a villain. The fact that she's murdering witches, I mean, she's a serial killer, right? I mean, she kills people in order to gain
her son, right? Because her son would lure them in and she would kill them. And that was, and you know, they try to make her a sympathetic character, but now don't get me wrong. I don't find Agatha, and that's been my struggle with the whole show, is that I don't find Agatha a sympathetic character. But in that ninth episode, you know, the fact that her son passes away and, you know, it's illustrated as this tragic moment. I'm like,
well, and she's trying to gain the power to save him, right? Mm-hmm. And he's a reluctant partner in that, that we see through those flashbacks. But all the same, she's a serial killer and a sociopath. I have a problem with, I'm supposed to be fond of her, and there's supposed to be a redemption arc.
Because she's funny, you know.
Right. I have a conflict with that, but I also had a real problem with how the character concept gets abused in the MCU process. I mean, they took the name and the fact that she's a witch and then just ran with it, you know. I know that there's probably not a TV show to be made of Agatha Harkness from the Fantastic Four comic books of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, but, you know, it just rubs me the wrong way that let's take this name and let's take, you know, one part of her identity, and that's what we're going to run with, and we'll just make her a villain.
I don't have those issues, and that's only because I don't – while I have – awareness of Agatha Harkness, I don't have the familiarity of the character that you do.
Mm-hmm.
I found the show was, honestly, I enjoyed the show. Let me clarify. I enjoyed
the
show quite a bit. You know, and just to kind of mirror some of my previous comments, I enjoyed everybody in the show more than I enjoyed Agatha Harkness. Which was kind of my main gripe in the show, is that, you know, it's about Agatha, but really everyone else is more interesting and more sympathetic and more who I'm rooting for. But they, you know, because Agatha's funny, you know, she's got this, you know, you mentioned redemption arc. She's not really redeemed at any point. Like, I mean, she sacrifices herself ish.
Yeah.
but you know, it's a fine sequel to WandaVision. I will say that.
Oh no, I thought it felt like an organic sequel to WandaVision. It didn't feel like one of those things they had to cast around for a story. It felt like the story really kind of came ripe off the tree. But I do feel like there was an effort to redeem her character, to make her more likable. And I'm just like, no, still a serial killer, still a sociopath. You know, there was no real personal sacrifice. And I kept thinking, you know, because she's killing all of these very likable people, right? You know, in her coven in the show. And I kept thinking, oh, we're going to get these people back. You know, no, they're dead. You know, just straight up dead. And I'm like, damn. You know,
even though she was not directly responsible for some of the main characters dying in this show, she knew what was happening and didn't stop it from happening.
Well, and
she couldn't kill the most awesome character in the show because that character is death.
Well, there is that.
Well, and there's an argument to be made that Billy's responsible for those deaths as well.
Yes.
Because he set up the whole thing.
And he does say that, you know, but he didn't know. I think there's, yes, Billy unintentionally killed these people, which frankly kind of rings a little bit to his mother's arc in Avengers Disassembled, right? The comic books.
Yeah.
Like, these characters died. She didn't even know that she was creating this alternate reality that caused it. And that's basically, you know, what we see with Billy here. But there's also not a lot of, like, there's acknowledgement, like, oh, wait, I killed all those people. And she's like, you didn't know. And then it's like, okay, let's go find your brother. Like, it would have, the ending, despite the fact that I enjoyed the show, I felt like they blew off or didn't give emotional weight to the level of murder that these characters are responsible for, intentionally or not, just to kind of move on to the next, you know, the next thing. I still enjoyed it. It's still worth watching. I very much liked the Billy character. I'm very much looking forward to seeing, you know, what happens next in for him as a character, whether it's a TV show or what. I would like to see Young Avengers, though I do think there's – I do have concerns at them being at the current state of the MCU being able to execute, you know, that Young Avengers story
effectively. They need to do Young Avengers now because these actors are aging.
Yeah. But what it's worth, Hawkeye, she's not that young anymore.
Yes. They've been introducing him over so long of a time that they're not going to be young anymore.
Yeah, I am really looking forward to the Vision Quest series that Terry Metalis is running. That starts shooting, I think, in March for an early 26 release. I am stoked for that one. I hate how long it's going to take for it to come to screen. But, you know, I am so pleased with what Terry Metalis did on both Star Trek Picard Season 3 as well as 12 Monkeys. I cannot wait to see what he does in the MCU.
Yeah. Well, so here's an interesting little factoid for you gentlemen, just because we're talking about Young Avengers. Haley Steinfeld, who plays, you know, young Hawkeye, is actually older than Scarlett Johansson was when the first Avengers film came out. So I don't know that that Young Avengers is going to be the right name since they haven't even started filming it. She'll probably be 30 by the time the film comes out.
Middle-aged Avengers.
Yeah, nearing middle-aged Avengers.
Yeah.
30-something Avengers. But yeah, I mean, it's I agree with you, and I'm very curious how Vision Quest will come out. But overall, I did enjoy Agatha all along. It's probably not one I'll revisit. But I'm glad I invested the time to watch it. And for the show that it was, the ending was good. It's not like it's resonated with me emotionally or it's going to stick with me to the point that I want to revisit it, but the ending stuck the landing in the context of what the show was.
Well, and Aaron, you hit on it. It's a perfect sequel for WandaVision because it has a lot of those same themes when it gets down to, he did a horrible thing not realizing he was doing it, just like Wanda was doing a horrible thing not realizing she was doing it. It's kind of the same theme.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, it was certainly right in the mode without retreading the same tire. You know, so it didn't feel repetitive, but it's certainly the same flavor. But I think overall it was really good. There are just things that irritate me about it.
Well, speaking of unintentional, horrible things, you guys are still reading Ultimates for some reason.
You know, and I know that Wayne does not feel the same way as me, but I really enjoyed issue number 6.
I am curious what you liked about it, because I really hate this Iron Fist Zen Hulk.
Oh, I see. And that's I really like Iron Fist Zen Hulk. So I guess we've come to the core of it. Plus. Best thing ever, he kills Iron Lad this week.
I did have a feeling you would enjoy that.
Oh my gosh, it was great. It was just gross. Oh yes. And you know, the downside is I'm confident they're going to bring him back in the next issue, but at least I get to live with one issue of Iron Lad being dead.
I found it interesting they did kind of a callback to how Wasp died in the original Ultimate Universe.
Mm-hmm.
They have this big giant guy who may or may not be supposed to be Blob, eat her.
Yeah.
But she bursts out of his stomach.
Yeah. The way you do that. You go to full size and burst out of their stomach. You know, as long as you can survive the mouth, you know, you have an opportunity to do that.
Well, that they didn't just make her come out like, well.
Yeah.
Like, she's out of it after that and like drenched in stomach acid.
Right.
And,
Yeah, no, I mean, she's a mess when she comes out. But, you know, everybody's a mess in this book. You know, the, you know, Iron Fist, you know, Ultimate Hulk just destroy. Not only does he kill, you know, Iron Lad, but he crushes and tears off the hand of She-Hulk. I mean, this is people take some significant damage in this book. And I think my biggest complaint about this story is that clearly they were set up, right? Tony Stark, Iron Lad, is saying, you know, I was able to decrypt this information and hack their system, which I shouldn't have been able to do, but that's how awesome I am. Instead of going, you know, you shouldn't have been able to do it. Maybe it's a trap, you know, and Captain America should have caught that. And that's what ticks me off is that I feel like they made our characters stupid in order to fight this battle. But that said, I really enjoyed how all these guys got their asses handed to them and largely, you know, by Iron Fist Hulk, who, you know, just tore them all apart. And
I didn't have a problem with Cap not picking that out because he is still so fresh out of time that he doesn't understand hacking.
I think, but I agree, but he should have understood what Iron, because he was standing right there when Iron Lad saying it, I shouldn't have been able to, but I was able to. And, you know, he should have gone, wait a minute, if you shouldn't have been able to do it, maybe we need to take another approach here.
I think my biggest problem with the book is they are failing to make me care about any of these characters.
Uh-huh.
The only one I find that I like at all is She-Hulk.
Same. I really like She-Hulk.
And so when you do something like this where they're being brutalized, if I don't care about the characters, then it doesn't have the impact the writer is trying to have on me.
Yeah. I have a real problem with the fact that Sif and Thor were not able to handle the fight better. Thor just seemed like he was tossed around like a rag doll. He didn't feel like he had any presence there at all. And Sif was trying too hard to cover him, that she wound up being vulnerable. It just, you know, they're not a fighting unit yet. And I felt like Wasp was the only one with any, you know, real cojones, you know, fighting. And of course, she's arguably one of the least powerful Avengers.
Well, and you hit on my issue with Thor in the book overall, not just this issue. He doesn't have a presence that a Thor should have.
Exactly.
Like he's a bland character.
He really
when
is.
He should be better. And that's what my whole issue with this book is, that these characters are not interesting and they should be. Mm-hmm. So if I don't care about the characters, I'm not going to enjoy the series. And I think I'm dropping out after this one because I just really hated this issue.
Well, I'm going to be carried forward because I enjoyed Ultimate Iron Fist Hulk enough, and the fact that he did me the favor, the solid, if you will, of killing Iron Lad. So I'm there for it. Hey, Paul.
Yes, sir.
Talk to me about Aliens versus Avengers number 2.
I feel like Aliens versus Avengers is a book you're either going to love or you're going to hate. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you're only going to enjoy this book if you like the more recent, or at least understand or appreciate the more recent Aliens movies, like Prometheus and Alien Covenant and now Romulus, because this story is very, very rooted in the super science of the engineers and that story arc that was really kind of explored in the recent movies. And a lot of people don't like that, mm-hmm. which is why the new movie Alien Romulus kind of it referenced it, but it wasn't so based in it like Prometheus and Covenant were. Mm-hmm. So I think it's an interesting choice. It's definitely something that's up Jonathan Hickman's alley, and so I can see why he is, which is, you know, for those who are not familiar, I'm talking about the engineers who are basically the creators of life on Earth. But also, you know, basically what happens is they create life on Earth. Life on Earth creates androids like David, I think is the android from Prometheus.
Correct.
And David, taking inspiration and wanting to become a god himself like the engineers, creates the ultimate killing machine, which is the alien. And that's kind of what happens during the story of Prometheus and Alien Covenant. And so that kind of, that is very much heavily referenced in this Alien versus Avengers story arc.
And certainly much more in issue two than in issue one. I like yourself, I was like, wow, this is really surprising that they're leaning into the newer mythology versus the older. It was very surprising.
Yeah, or lack thereof, right? I mean, you know, Aliens up until Prometheus were basically, yes, there was stuff that was set up in the original Alien that was just never explained.
Right.
But just an alien. It's literally called Alien. It's an alien. When in reality, it's not at all. It's an android-made killing machine. Very interesting. I will say, despite the connections, because I'm not the biggest Prometheus or Covenant fan, I appreciate it, but I don't love those because it's just, you know, it takes away, I think, from me what the concept of Alien and Aliens were. But I'm actually really liking this book quite a bit. I think it is, and I understand why Wayne with the first issue did not like it. So did not read the second. I understand it is not the story that I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be a modern day, maybe Elseworlds take on, you know, the Avengers fighting the aliens. And it's very much not. It's very much something set in the future. Earth has already been devastated. There's a lot of desperation here. There's, only a ragtag group of Avengers left. And, what we see in this issue is that some Avengers are able to escape Earth and some Avengers are left behind. And it's so different than what I expected, but so on point for a Jonathan Hickman, Esad Rivik story. Yeah. I mean, the art is just beautiful. I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, no, it is definitely right there in Jonathan Hickman's wheelhouse. This very much has the flavor of some of what Kieran Gillen was doing on the Eternals. There is this very high concept sort of feel to the story that I'm very much enjoying. Yeah, I want to see modern day Avengers fighting aliens. But the desperation here and how nicely this loops into the storylines from Prometheus and Covenant are really well executed. I mean, I think Jonathan Hickman's done a marvelous job here. And the artwork by Esad Rivik is just gorgeous.
It's crossover worthy. It's beautiful. Yeah,
it is so cinematic.
It is. I think it's hard because, you know, the superhero versus alien or predator has been done, like in modern day, has been done so perfectly with Batman versus Predator and Superman versus Aliens that it's hard to top that story because basically everything else is just a retelling of a similar story, right? Like, oh, what's this happening in my city? Oh, it's a Predator and we're going to fight and it's going to call back to the things you love in the movie, but, superhero's going to survive. Whereas this, you know, dares to take a different path with it and I'm enjoying it quite a bit.
Yeah. It's after we've already lost. It's great. I think it's a terrific story. I'm very much enjoying it.
Yeah. Well, things we have been enjoying, you know, moving over to the distinguished competition, we have enjoyed, and Aaron, I know you haven't read it, but it's very good. Absolute Batman, number one. Really enjoyed that.
Stop trying to make Absolute Batman happen.
Hey, issue two's next week. Time to get caught up.
Okay. Absolute Batman happened. You just missed out.
Exactly. Absolute Wonder Woman was just fantastic. What did we think of Jason Aaron's start on Absolute Superman?
I kind of loved it.
I'm curious for Wayne, because Wayne is our resident Superman expert. Not that I don't care about your opinion, Aaron. We'll come back to it. I just care about Wayne's more. So Wayne, what do you think of Absolute Superman?
I enjoyed it, but I need more to know. It didn't feel like enough yet, if that makes sense. It's like a little taste of it. The way they're playing in the history and modern day, giving us a little bit of each. I'm very curious about this version of Krypton and a Superman
and
Superman that actually lived on Krypton and knows what it was like and knew his parents. That's a very different Superman. That's more of a Supergirl.
Yeah. So Superman is trans. Is that what we're saying?
That is not what we're saying.
No.
Don't get controversial on this podcast.
No, I like this as an alternate version of the character. He very much is still, he's still the good that you expect out of Superman. But he's a he's one that's questioning humanity and questioning what he's seeing because he has grown up on a different planet.
Yeah. For me, I think this is very similar to, unlike the Batman and Wonder Woman books, I found this very similar to the J. Michael Straczynski Superman Earth One book.
I find it a little similar to the New 52 Action Comics Superman.
I could see that too.
You know, that the, you know, he's not as powerful. He's questioning a lot of things. He, you know, it feels. It has that. Was it Grant Morrison who wrote that? Is that right?
Yes.
There's a certain element of that. However, unlike a Grant Morrison book, I'm actually enjoying this one. Yeah. You know, I enjoyed the story on Krypton. I enjoyed the story of him making an intervention in a work camp, you know, in a third world work camp, you know, helping miners. I like how his, because the sun isn't as bright in this universe, he is not as powerful as we know him. In fact, he has to conserve his power and actually recharge at night, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, he uses artificial means to do that. It's not the Superman we know by any stretch of the imagination. However, the core is there that he's decent. You know, it appears that he didn't grow up with the Kents, might not even know the Kents, might not even have a Clark Kent identity. You know, he may be Kal-El all the time, right?
Yeah.
Just based on the age that we know he would have been, you know, at the oldest, you know, a 12-year-old, based on the images that we saw in the book, or at the youngest, a 12-year-old, you know, before he came to live on Earth. I'm fascinated by where the story's going, and Jason Aaron is such a good storyteller. I'm hooked. I'm ready for the next issue.
Yeah, and Aaron, yeah, you hit on one thing comparing it to other versions. I normally hate a Superman costume that seems to be alien. Mm-hmm. I've always liked the Ma Kent helped him build it, and
yeah,
but this is a version of Superman I can accept it on, mm-hmm, where he actually grew up on Krypton.
Yeah. I will say I don't love the costume, though. I enjoy everything about the costume except the fiery armband things. Like, I'm not quite, and I'm sure they'll be explained, but I feel like that's just an unnecessary over design.
The thing about the fiery armbands is that they're kind of doing something similar over in Action Comics right now. Which does happen in the regular DC universe because, you know, Superman's got these, you know, solar wristbands that help store energy as he's, you know, traversing the Phantom Zone. And so I'm like, you know, you guys really got to talk to each other.
Yeah. And if that's what they're supposed to be indicative of, I mean, they'll be explained, I'm sure. It's just, like I said, I don't know that I love that design. That, like, now I will say the one thing I do like is the living suit. Mm-hmm. I think, and I don't, they haven't explained
and that. And then it talks like, to
is
him.
Is it Kellex?
Yeah.
Or something else? So I'm curious, or is it Jor-El? It's probably not Jor-El. But I'm curious what the suit, you know, what his Jarvis is, basically.
Yeah. Well, and I'm also getting a kick out of that we positioned Lois Lane to be on the other side.
Yeah, like her
dad.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
There's a lot to like here. I think all three of these books are off to a strong start. I still think Absolute Wonder Woman is probably the strongest.
Of the two I've read, I would agree with that.
Well, maybe you should read all three just to have an informed opinion, Aaron.
Not going to happen, Paul.
Ultimate Batman was very good.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Tell me Catman was in it now.
He was.
Absolute Catman.
Absolute Catman. Anytime now. Uh-huh. You know, so the last two books we've really enjoyed. And I will say I was very much looking forward to the relaunch of JSA because I just could not get into the last Geoff Johns run. And that's sad for me to say, but I feel like Geoff Johns was he was focused on setting up Ghost Machine and that story suffered for it. Mm-hmm. But Jeff Lemire is a very skilled writer who I mm-hmm. enjoy quite a bit. So I was looking forward to him taking over JSA. The art by Diego Orlotegui, you know, an artist I'm not familiar with, but very much for whatever it's worth. Very superhero-esque action, you know, kind of 90s-ish, honestly.
There's a certain Ryan Ottley to his artwork. And who's the guy who did all the Ultimate Spider-Mans back in the day?
Bagley?
Yes, Bagley.
Yeah, I can see that. Very Bagley, very Ryan Ottley, very Todd Nauck, you know.
Yeah.
Very similar to those styles. Yeah,
very much the art style I like in a superhero book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I did not like the writing on this book.
It was, number one, it was a little wordy. And I felt like, you know, Jeff Lemire had a lot of lifting to do to dig out of the recent Geoff Johns run, which is hard to say because Geoff Johns has always been so brilliant on the Justice Society books. But to your point, not so much on the previous run. Not so much, in fact, that I've not finished reading the previous run because it had just gotten so leggy, you know.
Same here. And I never finished reading it. And I feel like going into this, first of all, I will say I love the book, but it did not feel like a first issue. It felt like I was coming in the middle of a story. And because I didn't finish reading the last one, I didn't know what was going on. It needed one of those first page of previously on. And for a first issue, it especially needed that because
last time on Justice Society,
if it's going to be a jumping on point for people, it needs to explain what happened. So you're not thrown right into a story and have no idea what's going on.
I was deeply amused in the mission briefing where Sandman is, you know, talking about the JSA members who are missing, right? From apparently the prior storyline with Geoff Johns. and he's gesturing to their images up on the screen because he's created this a PowerPoint presentation to indicate, you know, which JSA heroes are missing. And, you know, Stargirl, Atom Smasher, you know, Mr. Terrific. I'm sorry, these aren't the ones who are missing. These are reservists they're going to call in. But on the previous one, he was showing the ones who are missing, which are, you know, Alan Scott.
Jay Garrick.
Hawk Girl, Hawkman, or as they refer to them, the Hawks, Dr. Fate. And he's got them up on the screen, you know, his PowerPoint presentation, as if the people around the table don't know who these people are. And I'm like, yeah, I get that that's for me, but your storytelling should have just had a little side panel, not to make it diegetic, right? Not to make it in the room as part of the story. It should have just been something for me to tell me who those characters are, because the people in the room don't need the PowerPoint slide. You know, they don't need to, oh, that's what Alan Scott looks like. You know, he's been gone for a week. I forgot what he looked like. You know, it's just, I thought that was ridiculous.
See, my issues with this book, and perhaps they go to the stuff you're saying, maybe we are in the middle of a storyline that was unresolved from Geoff Johns. I actually didn't take it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I actually took it as we're starting in media res and they're going to explain how everyone got here. And that could
certainly be. Yeah, absolutely.
But I didn't like, and honestly, this is a major insult, and I don't mean it to come across as a major insult, but it hit me very much the same way that the recent Defenders of the Earth book did, which is that, like, everyone hates each other and no one's getting along. And I don't want to read that. That's not the JSA that I want to read in the first issue.
I did have that reaction to what was going on between Jesse Quick and Hourman, because I really like them. And the fact that it just kind of felt like an artificial fight, that really bugged me. I was just like, come on, I don't want to see this. And I don't think that that's the way these people would argue with one another, you know? Yeah,
but you also had Sandman and Jade. You also had,
Obsidian.
Yep. I said, yeah, you also had like the people arguing at the, like Jesse Quick and the lady who's, the cat lady.
Yeah, but I keep wanting to say Black Cat, but it's not same. Black Cat.
Wildcat.
Wildcat. Yeah, you had Wildcat who went off on her own mission with Obsidian, and everyone
because Obsidian's like, not actually Obsidian. Obsidian. He's not
Obsidian. Yeah, but it just felt like everyone was yelling at each other. I'm like, I don't know that your first issue is the book where everyone's basically hating each other.
Right. See, I really liked it. What I like is this whole idea that without the originals, they're falling apart. They're missing the heart. And the fact that they have a traitor within them gives it even more weight, especially because the traitor being Obsidian, he would have been the character that would be acting potentially like this anyway.
Right.
You can actually buy it in the story and buy their fighting. I well, perhaps really
the issue that I have is that it's a first issue, right? And I was expecting new reader friendly, and there was nothing new reader friendly about this book.
So I absolutely loved it. I'm 100% on board. It was a terrible first issue.
I did like the art. I know we referenced what the artist was like, but I very much like the art.
The first appearance of Obsidian in the book, where he's terrorizing the two Cobra agents, is terrifying. You know, where he comes out as like this, you know,
like venomish.
I mean, with multiple arms and, you know, he's all skeletal. I mean, I was just like, fuck you, man. I'll tell you anything you want to know.
And the colors. I would say the colors, you know, this is kind of a weird thing. We never really comment on the colors, but the colors sold this book for me. I mean, just great coloring. Every color, you know, the greens and the reds and the yellows and the superhero colors pop, and none of it's muted. So it's just, you know, it's a fun book to look at.
I absolutely love it, but it's a terrible first issue.
I agree. I'm in for issue 2, though.
I'm going to give it a shot. I don't know that I'm all in like DC wants me to be, but I'm in for the second issue.
So Paul, talk to me about Conan the Barbarian.
This book is so good. Aaron. It is so good. Battle of the Blackstone. So it's not, you know, it says Conan above the title, but it's very much, you know, a crossover of all Robert E. Howard's character creations. Some of them, but my favorite thing about it is that there's an essay at the back of each issue about some of the characters, and some of them have literally only appeared in like three stories, three short stories. One of them was never published during Robert E. Howard's lifetime. I think Darkna Agnes, all of her stories were published after his lifetime, after he died. And I find that fascinating. But, you know, they bring all these characters in. And one of the things, the first issue didn't set this up, but I appreciate that it happened in the second issue, that these characters are all dealing with this Cthulhu-esque, this eldritch horror, which was very much, you know, Robert E. Howard, but you know, did the same thing. But he, you know, this Jim Zub finds a way to bring all these characters together. And I was worried that in the first issue that we were just going to see these characters interacting with this horror in their own timelines, and that's how they were going to connect. But no, every character is brought back to the Hyborian Age and interacts together, and that happens in issue 2, and I love it. And I love how meaty, how much happens in each one of these books. Because it's only a 4-issue series, there's only one issue left, but so much happens. It feels like I've read 4 issues of story, and we've only read issue 3. And I will say the only qualm that I have about this book is that something happens at the end of issue 3 that removes all stakes from the book for me, because characters had been dying throughout the first two issues, dying hard, like torn in half. Like
spoilers, Agnes gets bitten in half.
I mean, characters have been dying violently, and I was like, wow. But you know, they're also like lesser known characters, so who cares? You know, they didn't kill Solomon Kane, they didn't kill Conan, and then you get to the end of issue 3, and spoilers, Conan dies, and I'm like, okay. Now I know that this is going to be that somehow this will be undone by the end of issue 4. And that was a disappointment to me.
But I have to say, Brissa was dead before this story started, and Brissa's in the story.
That's true.
So that the stakes were already questionable. Right. And, you know, I mean, it's comics, Paul.
I know. But it was. Well, I will say we also don't know where Conan is in this.
Well, we know he's 100%. Not King Conan yet, right?
Yeah, he's not King Conan yet. So, yeah, I mean, he'll clearly be back. But that being said, it's a minor thing that I'm like, okay, well, now we know these characters will be brought back to life. But it doesn't really remove the enjoyment. It just removes the stakes. It's still such a fantastic book. And the drawing is, you know, the art is amazing. The giant eldritch horror, you know, creature that torments them throughout time.
Well, and we don't know that the space that they're in, you know, they're traversing this dark jungle trying to get to the source of the Blackstone. And we don't know that this is a real space. We don't know that it's in our world or another world. All of this could be, you know, I don't know, almost imaginary, right? Like it's, you know,
true
on an, because on an astral they, or yeah. So I feel like it could be a different reality. And, you know, when you die out of it, you wind up in another reality. You know, I mean, I feel like there's so much magic happening. It's hard to know what the rules are. Right.
Yeah.
And we already, I mean, you can tell that the rules are already at play because Brissa died in a previous issue and she's here. You know, we can suspect that, you know, Conan being, you know, the hallmark character of this story, he's dead. We can expect he'll be back. So I feel like there's more on the edges that we're not aware of. Yeah. I think there's something more magical and fantastical yet to come.
Well, and one of the things I'm looking forward to is some of the, you know, like I mentioned, there's an essay at the back of each book.
Yeah.
And there's also a letters page where they hint that, you know, things may be taking shape, you know, in next year for some of these characters in this book. They said a certain fan favorite character will be getting their own 4-issue miniseries. Who knows? I don't know if that's Solomon Kane. I don't know if that's Dark Agnes or someone else. But I love all of the characters in this book, and they're all very different, right? You know, Dark Agnes is, you know, set during the French Revolutionary War, and Conan during the Hyborian Age. And then you've got Solomon Kane, who's like late 1800s, you know, religious horror. And they find a way to bring them all together. And I want to read more about every single one of them now.
Yeah.
And especially the two occult detectives, Professor John Conrad and John Kirwan. I mean, all of them are different and fascinating and interesting, and I cannot recommend this book enough. All you really need to do is know who Conan is. The rest of them, they're explained enough that you get it. I'm, you know, and so there's one more issue in December, Battle of the Blackstone issue 4. But in November, there will be a book published, Cult of the Obsidian Moon, which is a tie-in novel. They say it is not required reading. It's more of background, I guess, for these characters or something. So I'm curious about it, but I'm very curious. I'm going to check out the book, and I'm looking forward to how the story wraps up, and I'm looking forward to what comes next.
Yeah,
but it's such a great book.
I really am enjoying it. I think the Conan books over there at Titan are just exquisitely done. Whether it's the regular ongoing Conan title, whether it is Conan and the Search for the Blackstone or Battle of the Blackstone or Savage Sword of Conan, I'm enjoying all three of these. It is a golden age for Conan stories. I mean, yeah, it's hard. It is surprising to be able to say this, but they're doing a better job of it than Marvel did recently with the Jason Aaron books.
That was good stuff. Don't get me
wrong. It was good. High praise for
this. This is better.
Books. Yeah, it is. And I, you know, it's hard to put my finger on what makes it better. But I am pulled into every single one of these Conan stories. And another book.
It's focus.
I think that's
something that Marvel books, you know, they got Conan and they're like, let's put Conan in everything all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And so they had Conan, Savage Sword. They had spinoff miniseries. They had Savage Avengers. And I'm like, mm-hmm. I think what's good here is they're focusing on Conan, you know, the core of the character and this core continuity versus trying to force him into something else.
Well, another book I'm really enjoying, and I mentioned it to the guys earlier this week, and nobody said a thing, but it is a book called Newbern.
I meant to say something about that.
It is by Chip Zdarsky and Jacob Phillips from Image Comics, I believe. It's a crime story, and the setup on the book is that retired cop Eastern Newbern is his name, goes to work for like the five big criminal families to function as their detective when someone is doing something to hurt them. When, you know, suddenly two of their guys wind up dead, they send him out, and he's got protection from all of the families, and his, you know, he is both judge, jury, and executioner essentially. It is fantastic. It is such a brilliant setup. If someone hasn't already optioned this for a film or TV series, they're crazy not to have done so. I'm reading this and I'm like, why hasn't somebody made this? I mean, it is so stinking good.
I will have to give it a read. Right now, if you read your comics digitally, the first volume, New Burn Volume 1, is only $6.99 and includes the first 8 issues.
Yeah, it's really just a very good book. I'm just enjoying it. It was hard for me to break off from that to read my new comics so that we could talk about them this week. So big thumbs up on New Burn. So, and I'll let you know what I think of Volume 2 because I'm going to read it immediately following. But hey, Paul.
Yes, sir.
What's coming out next week?
Well, next week we have another new number one, Arcbound, issue 1, which is from writers Scott Snyder, Frank Thierry, and Tom Hardy. Yes, actor Tom Hardy has teamed up to create a new science fiction book, co-written by Scott Snyder and Frank Thierry. It's a 12-issue series. First issue comes out next week from Dark Horse Comics. And from Marvel Comics, we get the latest issues of Conquest 2099, issue 3, continuing that Dracula 2099 saga. And we get the new creative team on Amazing Spider-Man, which is The 8 Deaths of Spider-Man, written by Joe Kelly, art by Ed McGuinness. And this is where Dr. Doom, who is now Sorcerer Supreme, this very much ties into the reign or rise of Emperor Doom or whatever it's called. This is kind of a tie-in on how that affects Spider-Man and how Spider-Man is now gets a new magic-powered suit and 8 extra lives to save the world from the new Sorcerer Supreme, Dr. Doom. And so that's what this story arc is going to be about. I'm looking forward to checking that out. From DC Comics, we get the latest issues of Action Comics, which is a milestone 1,075th issue, featuring the continuation of Phantoms by Mark Waid and Clayton Henry, as well as the continuation of the Supergirl storyline that's been going on in that book, as well as an additional story called Memory Lane, written by Joshua Williamson with art by John Bogdanov, Flash from the Past, if you remember that name. Looking forward to that. And we get the second issue of the book that Aaron is most dying to read, Absolute Batman issue 2, comes out next week as well. But the biggest new release, gentlemen, next week from Skybound and Image Comics, G.I. Joe issue 1 from Joshua Williamson and Tom Riley.
Are you excited, and Paul?
I am super excited because we have been given a preview copy from Image and Skybound to read, but they've redacted the last like 3 or 4 pages.
Of course they have, Paul.
And last time they did that, it was huge.
The last time they redacted the last few pages of a book was Void Rivals number 1, which is what set up this whole Energon universe. So very much looking forward to G.I. Joe number 1 and finally seeing what's in those redacted pages.
Oh, so exciting. Well, hey, we want to know what you thought about this week's books. Which of the Absolute books are you enjoying? And how many times did you go back and reread The Murder of Iron Lad? Give us a shout at ideologyofmadness@gmail.com. And if we use your comments on the show, you could win a coveted valuable Ideology of Madness surprise.
You can also hit us up on social media, IOM Geek on Facebook, Instagram, and X.
All right, guys, I'm looking forward to chatting about all these things except Absolute Batman next week.
I'm going to chat about that first.
All right. I'll be late. Bye, guys.
Podcast theme music graciously provided by Mark Andrew Pope. For more information, visit markandrewpope.com. Funny Books with Aaron and Polly is a production of ideologyofmadness.com. No Spider-Man clones were harmed in the production of this podcast.